The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Well, good morning. Welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. I'm Sean Sayre here with you this morning. It is Thursday, September 26th, and we're live here in the studio at 4 Federico. Welcome to the show. I'm glad you're along for the ride this morning. We have a great show coming up for you all about housing this morning. We're speaking with the State Secretary of Housing and Livable Communities, Ed Augustus, along with Eileen Peltier, and she's the CEO of Hearthway, a regional housing nonprofit. If you remember back a few months ago, we did a pretty good comprehensive program on the Affordable Homes Act. And, you know, since the time that we spoke here in the studio last time, that Affordable Homes Act has passed the legislature and signed into law by the governor. So we're doing a follow-up show today to talk about the implementation of that law and all the things that will come along with it. Another show all about housing this morning. I'm sure that it's going to be fascinating. You want to stick around and listen to the whole thing. First, let's go to the weather forecast and find out what we have in store for us from the National Weather Service today.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, showers. A slight chance of thunderstorms this morning, then a chance of thunderstorms this afternoon. Warmer with highs in the upper 60s. South wind 5 to 10 miles per hour with gusts up to 20 miles per hour. Chance of rain 80%. Tonight, mostly cloudy. Showers likely with a chance of thunderstorms in the evening, then a chance of showers after midnight. Lows in the lower 50s. West wind around 5 miles per hour. Chance of rain 70%. Friday, mostly sunny. Highs in the mid-70s. Northwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
Well, there's something we haven't heard in the forecast in a while. Rain, thunderstorms. We've been kind of foreign to that for a while. We've had a really nice streak of weather here at the beginning of September. But now we're getting into it, and a little bit of water out there for your hardy mums and your lawns not getting as brown as they were. So good to hear that we're getting a little rain. All right, welcome back to the program, Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR FM. And I'd like to welcome my guests this morning, Ed Augustus and Eileen Peltier. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you, Sean.
Yes, thank you. Good morning.
You bet. So fantastic to have you here as a follow-up to our last show, and thank you for stopping by the studio to talk about this very important issue. How it started and how it's going, right? That's what the meme is. How are we doing now that the Affordable Homes Act has been passed into law? I'm sure we're really only at the starting line of being able to implement that.
Yeah, it was a very exciting development that less than a year after the governor filed the bill, that the legislature was able to take action before their session ends. In the second year of the two-year legislative session, they have to wrap up formal sessions by the end of July. So there's always a big rush to move a lot of bills. Mm-hmm. And some bills made it, some bills didn't make it, but I'm very happy and excited that the Affordable Homes Act did make it through that process. And it has substantial new resources available to my office, but really to all of the organizations, developers, and partners throughout the Commonwealth who actually build housing or help preserve housing. So the $5.2 billion authorization helps recapitalize many of the important programs that we use to do just that. Things like capital improvement to our 43,000 state-owned public housing units, recapitalizing and hitting historic levels of funding for our Affordable Housing Trust Fund, our Housing Sustainability Fund, our new supportive housing initiative are all robustly funded in this bill. But what's fairly unique for a bond bill is there's 49 different policy initiatives that were also adopted at the same time. And
that seems like a lot.
That is a lot.
One law that would come through and change one policy, and yet this one act took 49 different policy changes. So what are some of the larger ones that you see?
For the first time ever, it creates an Office of Fair Housing within our new secretariat, which is important to make sure that folks know what their rights are under the Fair Housing law, as well as their responsibilities if they are folks who are operating in the housing space, renting out property, real estate folks. Anybody in that space has certain obligations around fair housing, and we want to make sure that we've got compliance. So the goal is making sure we educate folks and people know what their rights and responsibilities are. Probably the most talked about policy initiative is ADUs, accessory dwelling units. Sometimes they're called in-law apartments. And historically, the decision about whether ADUs were allowed rested exclusively at the local level. And the 351 cities and towns had all sorts of different levels of ability to have ADUs in their community.
And could a local municipality actually ban them?
Yep.
Really?
And some did. And some didn't outright ban them, but they banned them in practicality in the sense that there were so many restrictions on them. It made it nearly impossible to get financing, like requiring it only to be for a family member. So if you have an elderly parent and you want to build it out, you know, if the parent passes away, then you have a unit you can't use. And so there were those kind of restrictions that didn't make it, you know, financially feasible or practical for a lot of folks to actually do ADUs.
And I assume there were probably some very tight restrictions about having to get special permits and all the other things, right?
Exactly. And some of them had parking requirements that were very kind of, you know, challenging to make it make sense or have it work for different communities and different family members. So this really strikes away most of those restrictions. The one restriction that a local community can put on ADUs is if they want to ban the seasonal, the rental of those communities, the short-term rental, like Airbnbs.
Right, and I know we'll probably want to talk about that a little longer,
sure.
too. Yeah,
because the goal isn't really to create more Airbnb opportunities. The goal is to create more housing.
Yeah.
And we know there's some number of folks, you know, who are maybe overhoused. They are by themselves now. Their spouse has passed away. The kids have grown up. They're in a big house. They want to downsize, but they also want to stay in the community that they've lived in their whole life. But sometimes there just aren't options to do that, to kind of downsize. So by having these ADUs created, it doesn't cost the state any money. Property owners decide to do this. But it can create some movement where that house that they're in then becomes an opportunity for a growing family that needs those bedrooms and the yard and the bigger house. So we think about 8,000 to 10,000 units will be created around the state in the next 5 years just with that one policy change alone.
Wow. And I would imagine that's probably, as great as that is, still a drop in the bucket in terms of how much of a need there is now for housing on all levels, right?
Yeah, we talk about being short about 200,000 units across the state of all types. And so the bill itself is estimated to create or preserve about 65,000 units that otherwise wouldn't be created. We create a certain number of units anyways just through our existing programs and systems. So this is 65,000 more, which over the 5 years, we'll have to reauthorize this bill 5 years from now. So I think it'll really increase the amount of housing that we're able to produce and to keep online.
Great. And Eileen, over to you. You know, the big issues in housing right now, we just talked about before we got on air, affordability and availability, and you brought up a third point, which is?
Which is access, which actually ties to you know, the Fair Housing Act, you know, that was passed in the 60s around the time of the Civil Rights Movement is one of the least regulated acts in the country, meaning it exists, but it's often not enforced. So it is no small thing that the secretary will have an office to administer that and ensure there's compliance. And, you know, much of the lack of compliance, you know, I believe is probably due to not fully understanding what rights people have, right? Mm-hmm. And that you can, you know, discriminate without even knowing it. So I'm actually really excited about that particular policy. And there are some other policies which really help tenants' rights, you know, the eviction ceiling. There's some interesting things in there that have been around for many years, so that we've been trying to make into policy. So the 49 is no small thing. I mean, that's just a piece of it around this idea of access, which is, you know, incredibly important during the times we're living in. You know, there's so much need. People have so many challenges that it is incredibly important that we make sure that the playing field is equitable and equal for everyone trying to access housing. So,
yeah, and from what I understand, too, it's a problem at all levels, right? Certainly the affordable housing area and critical sort of emergency housing is an issue. And then there's also a crunch at the other end in the sort of middle of the range, you know, building new houses, for example, or, you know, the turnover of existing houses. I think you mentioned, Secretary, the, you know, are you overhoused? Mm-hmm. And we would never have considered that as even a term that we would use, right?
Yep.
Who wouldn't in the world would be overhoused? You downsize when you need to, and that's it. But there have been some forces in the market also, I would imagine, that have made those changes difficult for people, right?
Yeah, I really look at it as a life cycle housing. Mm-hmm. You know, you have different needs at different phases of your life. When you're, you know, maybe just starting out of school, maybe you've got a couple roommates and that works for a few years, and then you go out on your own, you might start your family and you start having kids, have different needs. And then the kids are gone and you're looking to downsize and age in place and you have different needs. And you know, historically, there have been enough slack in the system that when you were ready to go to another phase, you had options out there. You could look around and find the appropriate house that maybe was on one floor if you were looking to age in place that was relatively close to where you wanted to be and in your range. Now, that's often not the case. Mm-hmm. And so folks got stuck. Part of the reason they're stuck is a couple factors. One is we've not been producing enough housing. Mm-hmm. Two, the interest rates have been high, and so that's just now starting to change, which is hopefully going to be wind at our back as we implement this bill. Mm-hmm. And then third, some communities have been very, you know, forceful and aggressive in putting up barriers to certain types of housing, particularly family-oriented housing, multi-bedroom housing, rental housing, which has really limited, you know, folks' option as they move to a different phase. And so all those things have kind of conspired to create this housing crisis that manifests itself in so many different ways, some of which we talked about already.
I might add to that just the idea of aging in place and seniors. So we all know we're all living a lot longer. Mm-hmm. Pensions are not something that many people have anymore. Some are fortunate enough to have it. So we have a lot of seniors both struggling financially, aging in place, having medical challenges. And Secretary, you mentioned last night, and this is very much a thing in a place like the Berkshires, people want to age in place in Lanesboro.
Sure.
Not Pittsfield, yeah. Lanesboro, which is next door. Mm-hmm. That's their community. That's the connection. So, you know, things like the ADU or different creative ways to bring sort of the right-sized housing. So most of the Berkshires, it's family housing, right? There aren't a lot of options. We have a higher rate of single-family homes than rental compared to other parts of the state, right?
Okay.
Rental, typically you could have, you know, the one bedroom. Mm. You could find that type of housing.
Mm. Why do you think that is here in the Berkshires, so that we've grown up with that share of the housing that's different maybe than other parts of the state?
Well, I think it's a few things. One, it's infrastructure. So there's only a certain number of communities in a rural region like the Berkshires where it's, you know, financially viable to develop a multi-family building with 40 units because, you know, you don't have that infrastructure. It's just sort of the nature of rural living, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's just the history. And our housing stock is older in the Berkshires than anywhere else in the state.
Oh, that's interesting.
So
I knew it was old, but I didn't. I figured there would be some pretty old spots in the rest of Massachusetts, too. So,
well, there are, for sure, compared to other parts of the country, right? Yeah. New England's older.
Right. But has there maybe been more redevelopment in the eastern side of the state and different parts than in the Berkshires? Maybe larger investment?
Well, I think partly because just where jobs have migrated to, somewhat related to colleges mm-hmm. and where they've clustered. So, you know, Boston is a city that's a great example. It's constantly changing, right? The buildings go up, they come down, they change their facade, they change their use. And so it's a moving, organic thing, whereas mm-hmm. more rural communities tend to change less frequently and less rapidly. Mm-hmm. You know, even in my home city of Worcester, three families are one of the big housing, part of our housing stock, three-decker homes. And they played an important role as different waves of immigration came to the country. Often multiple generations lived in the same building and helped support each other and take care of each other. So there's a lot of history around the type of housing, where it is and how it was used and how it's been readapted for more modern uses.
Yeah, and now that you say that, I don't think that we have a lot of that style of housing even here in Pittsfield, in the largest city in Berkshire County, right?
Yeah, you know, I think
we have some multifamily for sure, and yep. we have some housing developments and projects and things, but I don't see that sort of multitude of those triple-decker apartments that you talked about.
Yeah, Worcester is a city with seven hills, and so you see all these big hills in the city with these really close-in three-family houses, one after another, really dense neighborhoods, which is something we talk a lot about now, looking for more density, particularly around transit opportunities, stuff which I know are much more challenging here in the Berkshires. But in order to advance some of your climate goals, where you do have transit options, you do want to tend to concentrate more dense housing so people have the option to walk to work or, you know, take a short ride to work as opposed to spending hours in their car.
Right.
And that, you know, that is the rural challenge, mm-hmm. right? You know, the Berkshires was about agriculture and, you know, sheep took up a lot of space.
Going back a ways.
But that defines the space. Mm. And I think, you know, to add to the challenge, it's also small. So when I'm in Boston pretty regularly. You drive through Boston and you go, oh, hey, another building, something came down. You don't really think about it. But when you're in a smaller community, even Pittsfield, and a building disappears or new construction happens, there's a lot of interest in what's going on. There's a lot of history. You know, having come to the Berkshires 3 years ago, I still get thoroughly confused because people refer to buildings and spaces, you know, by whoever, whatever it was 80 years ago, you know. So that's just sort of part of the culture in rural areas.
That's how you get directions, right, in the Berkshires. You just go by, you know, where the old A&P was, and then you take a right at this, you know, and it's all these old buildings that nobody knows where they are.
Exactly. And then I Google the address because that's the only way to get there. So, you know, it is a very different challenge. And of course, the transportation challenge is huge. Mm. But at the same time, you know, we need to think about climate as well, right? So trying to figure out how rural regions can create some pockets of density, mm-hmm. right? And if we create these pockets of density in the Great Barringtons and the Pittsfields and the North Adams and places like that, then, you know, can we connect some sort of rural transportation network, mm-hmm. right? Because we all know, and I think I said this the last time, but the affordability challenge to live in a rural region is not only the high cost of housing, it's the cost of transportation. Yeah. And you add those together, and it's a very big, challenging number.
Right. We're speaking today about housing here on Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR FM. And we're glad to have the Secretary of Housing and Livable Communities, Ed Augustus, on the panel here this morning, along with Eileen Peltier, the CEO of Hearthway, a regional housing nonprofit here in the Berkshires. And Secretary Augustus, to tell us again some of the other tools that we have in the toolbox now that the Affordable Homes Act has been passed. We talked about the 49 policy changes, and we didn't even really scratch the surface on those. Feel free to come back with more of the highlights there, because again, a lot of people listening might not even know, you know, that that's on their radar, that this is something that is in the works, and it's just really, you know, getting its sea legs at this point. Some of the other things that I think you mentioned, it's a bond bill.
Yep. So one other thing that might be of interest to many communities here in Berkshire County is the seasonal communities designation. Folks may have or may not have heard of something called the Gateway Cities designation that the legislature created about 15 years ago. Pittsfield is one of those gateway cities, one of the 26 across the state.
Right.
And there were specific programs and funding that was designed to support economic development, housing, and other issues in those gateway cities, recognizing that they had unique challenges and unique needs and so needed unique tools. So that same concept was brought to this bill, creating a seasonal communities designation, understanding that Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, some of the Cape communities, as well as some of the Berkshire communities, have unique issues. They may be locations where a lot of second homeowners have property,
mm-hmm.
Where the population surges during particular times of the year, doubles, triples,
right.
And that creates unique housing challenges. And so we have
and affordability challenges.
Affordability,
too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So the seasonal communities designation was created in this legislation, has an advisory committee that will work with my office to help come up with some unique tools that will help those seasonal communities as they come up with hopefully innovative, creative, out-of-the-box solutions to meeting those unique housing needs in those seasonal communities and taking some of the pressure off the housing ecosystems in those communities.
What kinds of help do you think that that they could come up with in this? Because I'm wondering, it seems like kind of a logjam, especially in the summer here in the Berkshires, and I'm sure the Cape and Islands have some of the same challenges, right? And those have a ripple effect throughout the rest of the year, where especially if you have short-term rentals and people are sort of gobbling those up and trying to, you know, make a buck on Airbnb. I mean, it's understandable, but it does have an effect on the rest of the year and the rest of the population.
Yeah, I think, you know, there might be some programs, some new programs that are designed. There may be carve-outs or special flexibility in existing programs that might be possible. Again, we'll have to look and see if there's have to be statutory changes for that. But, you know, I've seen some innovation in spaces where you're looking at the different seasonal uses. Is there one part of the year that you're using housing to support students, and in another part of the year you're using it to support a regional seasonal workforce? That can be challenging sometimes from a financing point of view, because that's a little out of the box, and you know, banks and capital sources don't always like out of the box thinking. So our subsidies and our support to those kind of programs are creating some more flexible financing mechanisms through our quasi-housing agencies, Mass Housing Partnership, CDEC, can sometimes help bridge the gap, the divide between a good idea or a workable idea and a more conservative, less flexible, you know, financing world to actually make that happen.
So it's placing some incentives basically in places where, you know, it might spark something, might be able to get something going where normally it would just sort of say, well, we can't get that done.
Yeah, or something that is a good idea. People know it's a good idea, just it's too different than the, you know, we do strawberry, vanilla, and chocolate. We don't do, you know, raspberry or something else. So we need to have the flexibility to say, hey, we'll try some raspberry today. Let's see if that works in this particular location. You know, there's some opportunities to do preferences for municipal workers. You know, there are some communities, and particularly familiar with the islands, that are facing a very unique challenge. In Nantucket, the median home price is $3.5 million.
Wow.
If you're a second grade teacher in Nantucket, I promise you cannot afford to live in Nantucket.
Right.
And so they do this island shuffle thing, and I think the same thing exists in some communities here in the Berkshires, that make it almost impossible to get people long-term to be willing to move and take jobs that are modest salaries, given that they can't sustain the rent, or they can only stay until May and then they have to get out and then find somewhere else for a couple of months during the summer and come back. Most people will only be able to do that for a short period of time, if at all.
Yeah. And that kind of goes to Eileen's point earlier about equity, right, and about affordability across multiple demographics. I mean, if you have an equitable community, you have places for everyone who do all the work in the community, as well as being able to have space for people to come in and support your economy, you know, in those critical summer months. I think that would be something, but we've seen that, and the word, I guess, gentrification comes to mind, right? Where you're kind of pushing out the people who are there, you know, to do the regular jobs. Where are they going to go? And I can't think of a worse place than Nantucket, where you really have nowhere to go, right? At least in the Berkshires, if you're pushed out of, let's say, a Great Barrington or a Stockbridge or a Lenox, there are other places a little further away, but not, you know, there's no water separating you from that.
Right. So just adding a couple thoughts on the seasonal communities designation. Mm-hmm. I know that I'm hearing from a lot of communities wondering about, whether or not they'll qualify. And the language has some sort of, you know, definitions of what makes qualify, but there's some vagueness to it. Mm-hmm. And I know, Secretary, that you mentioned last night, I think it's Berkshire Regional Planning would be part of that. Just, you know, having our listeners understand that there will be a process, there will be a way to sort of refine that, but it's not here yet. It's going to take a little time.
Yeah, the bill's passed about 40 days ago, we're in the process of staffing up, adding some staff so that we can implement the many parts of the law. And every law that's ever passed, legislature could never conceivably answer every possible question that might come up, every unique circumstance. So we do a process of putting out regulations or guidelines that try to answer those questions in alignment with the statute, with what the legislature intended. But when can you apply? How do you apply? Who's eligible? What are the criteria? All of those very specific things that need to be answered, the communities or organizations that might use some of these programs or policies need those answers. So,
and these are very technical details in a lot of ways, right? And so if you're not really tuned into this, it would be difficult to sort of get ramped up and understand it, how to navigate that.
I give you one very tangible example, because I was asked in a public setting and I didn't know the answer to it, that we have a new tax credit that gives a housing developer tax credits that have value, right, that helps pay for the project if they're going to convert a formerly commercial property to housing. And somebody said, well, if you tear down the property, is it eligible? Or is it just on an existing building that you're going to retrofit?
Interesting.
It's an interesting question. We need to think through what are the pros and cons of letting you be completely flexible, tear down that old mall and build housing there. So,
and where are those decisions made? Like, if there isn't an answer to that, does it have to go back and get re-decided somewhere, or can that be interpreted through the law?
Yeah, so that's what we'll do. So we'll work on, with our attorneys and our program staff, we'll come up with what we think are going to make sense for those answers, but that won't be the final word. We'll publish what we call draft guidelines or draft regulations, and then there'll be a public comment period. And then particularly the people who work in this space who will use these programs will say, hey, you didn't think about this, or you didn't take this circumstance into account, or if you change it this way, you know, it'll be more easy to use or more effective. And then we will change those. And then we will publish final guidelines and final regs that will allow folks to know what the parameters of the program are. So, you know, to the extent that there are folks out there who work in this space or interested, or you're on a town board or somehow involved in these issues, be thinking about your questions, whether it be around ADUs, around seasonal communities, around any other aspects of the bill. And, you know, there'll be a process to share those questions, to submit those, so that if we haven't thought about them, you'll help us think about them. And we want to get this as right as we possibly can. And that will be a back and forth process over the coming months.
And one of the things you just mentioned, Secretary Augustus, we want to talk about in the second half of the show after the top of the hour break, is sort of the reuse of older buildings, historic buildings, things like that. You know, here in the Berkshires, there have been a push, I think, to reuse older industrial sites. And I know Eileen is involved with a couple of those, and we want to talk about that. Old churches, for example, lots of buildings where people don't want to see the buildings themselves go away. And so, you know, here we are with a housing crisis. We have a need for housing, and you know that seems like a good fit. So this bill is something that will allow that to continue to move along as well.
There's a lot of, I think, new and expanded tools in this bill. The historic tax credit was doubled from $55 million a year to $110 million a year. So if you do have a historic church or a mill building or some other historic building that, again, the community wants to save, should save, but sometimes it's more expensive to do that.
Downtown buildings, for example.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Intact blocks. You don't want to tear down a building in the middle of an intact block and have an empty space. It's like a person missing a front tooth. That's not good urban design. And yet, you know, to have the windows comply with historic standards and the other elements of the building sometimes add costs. And so by expanding the historic tax credits, which often can leverage federal historic tax credits, that can close the gap. So you can save a piece of your history, but use it for some modern need if the original need has now passed. Yeah. So I think it's a great way to kind of keep the character of our communities and meet our housing needs.
And we'll talk with Eileen on the second half, the other side of the break, about the specific projects going on here in Berkshire County as well. If you're just joining us on Morning Drive, it's 89.7 WTBR FM, and we're speaking with the Secretary of Housing and Livable Communities at Augustus, and Eileen Peltier, the CEO of Hearthway, a regional housing nonprofit here in the Berkshires. And we will be right back with the rest of our conversation right after we thank our underwriters and identify our station, as we always do. This is 89.7. WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR-FM.
It's a revolution!
Yeah, baby, yeah!
89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield.
Support for WTBR comes from Tim's Lawn Care. It's almost time for fall cleanups. Tim's Lawn Care also could take care of your landscaping and fall lawn care needs. Also, ask about commercial and residential snow plowing for the winter. Tim's Lawn Care, 413-281-4222, and online at timslawncarelandscaping.com.
And UCP of Western Mass. Turn passion into purpose when you apply at UCP of Western Mass. Now offering full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. It's more than just a job, it's our identity. Apply today at ucpwma.org/jobs.
Hey, it's Sean from WTBR-FM. Whether you just found this station for the first time or you've been listening for years, you might not know everything about WTBR-FM. Want to find out more? It's easy. Just go to WTBRFM.com. You can find full programming schedules, listen to the station anywhere in the world, subscribe to our podcasts, and even learn to create a program of your own. And of course, donate to the station. That's WTBRFM.com. Check it out today. Where does democracy actually begin? Well, it begins right here at home, at our local city and school meetings, the place where really big decisions are made that affect you and your family directly. With good TV coverage, these decisions are transparent, our residents are well informed, and elected officials are held accountable. Without reliable coverage, these decisions go under the radar. Support PCTV's local meeting coverage today. Pittsfield Community Television, democracy starts here.
Larry Cracker here on WTBR, and I want to tell you about my show, Nothing But Old 45. I have an absolute blast playing my records here on WTBR for 2 hours every Monday morning, and I'll crank out the best of top 40 oldies and classic rock Mondays here on WTBR, the home of Nothing But Old 45 since 2014. Nothing But Old 45, Mondays from 10 a.m. until noon, here on 89.7 WTBR FM for the love of radio.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR. And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
Yes, welcome back to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Sean Sayer here with you again live in our WTBR studio this morning. Thursday, September 26th is the day, and a little bit of rain in the forecast. We'll get back to our discussion about housing in just a moment. First, let's get to the weather forecast from the National Weather Service. Berkshire
Weather. WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, showers. A slight chance of thunderstorms this morning, then a chance of thunderstorms this afternoon. Highs in the mid-60s. South wind 5 to 10 miles per hour with gusts up to 20 miles per hour. Chance of rain 80%. Tonight, mostly cloudy. Showers likely with a chance of thunderstorms in the evening, then a chance of showers after midnight. Lows in the lower 50s. West wind around 5 miles per hour. Chance of rain 70%. Friday, mostly sunny. Highs in the mid-70s. Northwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, a little rain in the forecast. Never going to hurt anybody. It's only when the snow starts flying that we're really going to pay attention to any of that, right? At least we're not in the path of the big hurricane coming toward Florida. My goodness. Thoughts and prayers out to those folks today and tomorrow. That's going to be pretty difficult down there in Florida for sure. Welcome back again. Morning Drive, 89.7 WTBR FM, and glad to have my guests here this morning. Again, Secretary of Housing and Livable Communities, Ed Augustus. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
And Eileen Peltier, the CEO of Hearthway, regional housing nonprofit here in the Berkshire. We appreciate both of you being here to talk about this very important topic this morning. So, Eileen, just before the break, we were teasing the idea of what projects your organization is involved in. The first one that comes to mind is the Eagle Mill down in Lee, right? That's anyone driving from Pittsfield to the Turnpike has noticed some progress there. And for a long time, it was just a fence and a lot of mill buildings. And now it's kind of a moonscape, right, where things are happening down there.
Well, I promise the piles will go away at some point. Yes, it is a hard-to-miss project, and it's going very well. It's very much under construction with an expectation of next summer completion. So it's 56 units. It is a nice mixed income project in that there are 20 units that are middle income housing and the balance being affordable housing. So, you know, we're really excited about that project. It absolutely happened because of both state and federal historic tax credits. I mean, it's a complicated capital stack that we put together, but that does make the difference when we're trying to do a repurpose, of a building like a mill.
You have to be kind of an artist to put all this together, right? It's not just one source where you say, okay, this project's going to happen because we have one funding source, and you have to put it together from all these different places.
Yeah, it's when I started doing this work almost 20 years ago, the colleague who convinced me to move from the healthcare side of things into housing said, Eileen, you will never be bored. It's incredibly calm. And that was someone in healthcare.
Yeah, so right.
that speaks to the complexity of it. And it has been true.
Yeah. And what are the other projects you have going on?
Well, I'll just mention related, of course, that site has three phases to it.
Okay.
So we are planning to make an application for phase two, which is actually new construction. So as a developer, that's always fun to do. So we both get to do a historic rehab and then a new construction building that will be 43 units.
Oh,
so
wow.
We'll be putting in to the funding round in January. I assume it will be in January for that. So and then there will be a third phase, which is around another 30 units, and we'll address the machine shop. That's the other historic building there. So,
is there any mixed use there? Is it all residential?
Well, the machine shop currently is zoned as commercial. I'm still sort of holding on to that hope that when we build the housing and we see what is possible there, what it's looking like, that we will be able to bring in retail commercial. But there is some thought that that could also be residential. So we'll have to see how it plays out. I'm hopeful that we could get a little bit of commercial retail in that shop. It might be lovely. And then, of course, the other projects, we have two projects in Pittsfield, so we haven't really talked about the need for permanent supportive housing. But certainly we all understand here in the Berkshires and across the country that homelessness is a big challenge, and, you know, senior homelessness is a big challenge, and, you know, the Berkshires is an older county. We are really seeing that, I know, in our numbers, in our shelters. So Hearthway is developing two different sites. One is the Zion Church on First Street in Pittsfield. It's a collaboration with them. They essentially will provide long-term leases for us to develop on what was the classroom. So the historic church, and then usually in the 60s, they kind of add some classroom space.
Right.
That will become 9 units of permanent supportive housing. And then we are also, with funding through the City of Pittsfield ARPA funds, able to develop in the lower level of the church almost 8,000 square feet of what will become a housing resource center. We're really excited about that. So it will provide a place for people who are unhoused to take a shower, you know, do their laundry, charge their phones. It's what's called the living room model. We're really excited about that. And then we are doing new construction on West Housatonic Street, another 28 units of permanent supportive housing. So good mix. And you know, in smaller communities relative to Boston, Pittsfield is a smaller community. It's nice to not have a really large building that's all permanent supportive housing and sort of becomes like, oh, that's where those people live. I like the separation, having two different projects. And, you know, it's been a very interesting process working with a faith-based organization, because, of course, we have separation of church and state. And I actually am very hopeful, speaking to sort of these old historic buildings, that we're learning some good things that my colleagues around the state can utilize. And how do you do something like this? Because I've always been curious about what is happening with these churches. They're in downtown spaces. They have so much potential. They're underutilized. We have a housing crisis. How can we connect the two? So I've actually been trying to do a project like this for like a decade, and I'm really happy that we have, you know, a strong partner in the Zion Church and the city, and we are going to be closing in a few short weeks and starting construction.
It's a marathon, not a sprint, as they say, right?
Yes, it's always a marathon.
Yeah, and dovetailing off of what Eileen just discussed, Secretary Augustus, let's talk about vulnerable populations and how the Affordable Homes Act can help that, because obviously the housing crisis, as we mentioned at the top, affects everybody at this point, at all strata, at all levels. Everyone's having some difficulty in that space, but it never hits harder than the people who are really the most vulnerable. And I think of seniors, veterans, disabled, what kind of tools do we have in the toolbox that will help with some of that?
Yeah, the new supportive housing program that's authorized in this bill really tries to provide some new and flexible resources. We know that in many cases, just creating a unit is not enough. Folks have some issues that need that kind of support long term to keep them successfully rehoused. They may be dealing with substance abuse disorder, mental health issues, physical health issues. And so those supportive services help them have a better quality of life, but help them stay rehoused. And there's a lot of overall benefits that we all get from that, the lower cost of health care, better outcomes. And so that is a real focus of this bill, and we're trying to provide some additional resources to do that. As Eileen mentioned, seniors are the fastest growing part of our individual homeless population.
Wow.
And, you know, it's not hard to understand why.
Yeah.
Folks tend to be on a fixed income at that stage of life, and Social Security, or maybe they do have a small pension or some small savings. So if
But it can go fast.
It can go fast. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, your home repairs get, you know, bigger than you can handle, or you get behind in your taxes, or if you do rent, somebody else comes in and purchases the property and the rent goes up significantly in a way that you don't have the ability to kind of meet. And we've seen folks across the state end up in their cars, mm-hmm. end up in shelters, and obviously that's horrific at that stage of life. So we want to do everything we can to support kind of, you know, best practices, models that we know work, that create the right type of housing with the right type of supports. Related to that is a $2 billion of the $5.2 billion. $2 billion is dedicated to improving the capital or making capital repairs to our existing state-owned public housing. We have 43,000 units of state-owned public housing across the state, including, you know, here in Pittsfield, as well as in many of the towns in the Berkshire area. Some of them are relatively small, maybe 40 units or 50 units, but those are critical units for folks who often have very low incomes, maybe just a Social Security check or some very small income level. So having that public housing is critical, because if we didn't, those 43,000 units have 70,000 people across the state living in them. And so imagine this housing market with 70,000 more folks on limited incomes out there trying to find an affordable place to live. It would be, you know, catastrophic. So job one to us is keep what we've got and make it more habitable, more healthy, more sustainable, more resilient where necessary. So this is a big focus of the bill as well.
I wanted to just jump in on that. So we do have several very small housing authorities in the Berkshires. And, you know, I don't work with HLC on the public housing side as much, but I'm assuming that there's some level of technical support going to be provided. So some of these small groups haven't done, you know, a substantial capital renovation in a very long time and don't necessarily have that expertise. And I guess I've been worried about, are they going to access the money? Are they going to know what to do and how to do it? So can you talk a little bit about the technical support side?
So actually, just yesterday, I meet quarterly with Mass NARO, who's the organization of all the housing authorities in the state. And we have programs, we have regional capital teams that work with the smaller housing authorities that do a lot of the capital planning, the design work, and do like clerks of the work who go out and oversee, you know, the new roof or the new septic system or the new, you know, window project that they may be doing. So some of the dollars that are going to go out will go for bigger projects like that. Some will go out in a formula that exists, but we'll now be able to put more money into that formula that the local housing authorities can do there. So when a unit turns over, that's sometimes an opportunity to put in a new sink or a new, you know, cabinets or do a tub cut because we want to have it more fully accessible for the next individual who comes in. A lot of our housing is for seniors and folks with disabilities. So, you know, we do have a structure and we are looking at expanding that structure so that everybody will benefit, not just the big housing authorities, but the small and the medium-sized housing authorities as well.
What's the demand like right now for those public housing authorities? Are there huge waiting lines? And I am hearing, you know, that we're talking years and not months or weeks.
So I'll be going today after I leave here to Pittsfield Housing Authority. And then later today I'll be in the Lee Housing Authority. I'm committed to visiting every housing authority in the state. This will
be an ambitious goal.
It is. There's 230 of them. This is my 71st and 72nd housing authorities. But that has given me an opportunity to go in units, to talk to tenants, to talk to the maintenance people, the executive directors, the boards. So I really am focused on making sure we're doing right by this very vulnerable population and understanding what their challenges and needs are. The housing authorities across the state, you know, many of them were built post-World War II. Some of them were for returning veterans. So if you think about that, they're 80 years old and have not been upgraded substantially in that whole time. So
every building needs maintenance. And we hear about school buildings where they pass 50 years and they start thinking, well, how long can this building really continue to serve these students? And I think these buildings probably have some of the same concerns, even older, you know, than some of the schools.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny, you see how different periods of time, you know, you say, what were they thinking? We've got a lot of, I was in Stockbridge a couple of months ago at their housing authority, beautiful facility, but they built two-story elderly housing. And so, you know, you're a senior and you want to age in place, but you're on the second floor, and there's a building in the middle of this kind of garden-style units, and that's where your laundry is. So if you're 80 years old, you've got to come down those stairs every week with your laundry, go across, hopefully it's not snowing, hopefully it's not icy, do your laundry and go back. So there's weird designs that were done, some in those cases, maybe in the 60s or 70s. So to the extent that we can make modifications, put laundries closer to folks' units so we don't have that, or do other things that are more commonsensical. You know, we can't put elevators in every one of those buildings. It wouldn't be possible. So you're doing the best you can with what you've got without taking any units offline, if at all possible.
Yeah. And it does show the unique nature of each community, right? And every if you're visiting every public housing authority in the state, I'm sure you're going to see a huge variety of different approaches, different eras, right, that they were built and how they match up to today's expectations, I'm sure, is completely different.
And, you know, I think it is very much about the changing expectation, just putting my sort of healthcare hat on for a minute. You know, in the 40s, you know, you were aging in place to a much earlier stop point where you either moved in with your kids or you had access to skilled nursing level of care or those types of things. And as we know, healthcare costs have risen like housing costs in this country. So we now have people aging in place much longer and, you know, putting themselves at risk, putting even the properties at risk at times, right? Because they're, you know, probably could use a higher level of care. So when the secretary, fixes the housing crisis, the next challenge is next week, right?
Yeah, that's exactly.
On the schedule for next
week. After maybe,
yeah. But that next challenge is, you know, because so much of the portfolio of housing, whether it's public housing or the type of housing I do, is aging in place. You know, how do we connect that to the system of skilled nursing, which, as we know, nursing homes are closing in Massachusetts. That's facing all kinds of challenges. I see that as a future challenge. And one of the tools that, you know, the supportive housing model is going to help with that, because, as we know, four walls and a roof are not enough for many of us. But certainly, as people age in place, if we can start to develop systems and approaches that can help them age in place in a safe, effective way, and bring those services in. So that's a big deal. Many states do not connect services and housing very effectively. We're all trying to figure it out now because we're seeing the need. But it's exciting to see that in the bill, that type of approach and the openness to thinking about the connection between those two things.
Well, it's really great to see, too, that there's such an increased focus on this, and just the ability of having this Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities, which didn't exist right before very recently, if I remember, and having the Affordable Homes Act now passed and having sort of the tools to bring to bear to make some of these changes, that's probably all got to be good news, again, only at the very beginning of the story.
Yeah, I'm the first housing secretary in 30 years, hopefully not the last. But Governor Healey, working with the legislature, created a standalone secretariat back in June of 23. Formerly, it had been part of the Economic Development Secretariat. And, you know, I think given the housing crisis, the governor's thinking was, hey, we need folks who wake up every day and just think about housing, just focus on, you know, the tools that we need, the attention that we need, the new funding that we need to support more housing production, preservation, et cetera. So, you know, we've been able to assemble a very talented team, I think, some really smart people who've helped us put this bill together. And that bill is not a reflection just of, you know, our thinking. It is very much a reflection of the folks out in the field, the folks who are doing the work day in and day out. We did a lot of really, you know, thoughtful and sustained engagement with folks to get those good ideas. And I think that was the secret. Like, there was something in there for everybody in this housing space. You know, when eviction record sealing, supportive housing, housing production, public housing, like, you were able to weave together a coalition of folks that this bill was too important not to pass, even when other bills were not successful at the end of the session.
Yeah, one thing I know we talked about just off air was the connection with the creative economy. I think that's something that Eileen wanted to bring forward. What was your question, Eileen?
Well, you know, here in the Berkshires, there's a lot of conversation about the creative economy and how, of course, they're bringing in artists and to the community for part of the year. Mm-hmm. So many of those organizations are spending a lot of money on housing. That's for 6 months. And, you know, how could we utilize the other 6 months? And there actually is a set aside in the bill for about $5 million to start to address this. Mm. So this can be one of those challenges ones, as the secretary said, sometimes it's hard to match up the money that is available in ways that that can work. So just curious about ideas around both how we might utilize something like that, but also just generally there are several set-asides that relate to the Berkshires, how you're going to manage that process. I'm hearing that a lot from communities about, do we just get a check? You know, not quite, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, again, this iterative process, some things that are in the final bill that became law were things that we proposed, some of the things that the legislature added. So they're new to us, too. And so we have to talk to the legislative sponsors and others and say, you know, what were you hoping to accomplish with this? You want to make sure you're, you know, enacting the legislative intent. And then you want to talk to the people on the ground, like what makes sense? How do we roll this out in a way that is it helpful, is not just kind of putting it out there. So.
And you've been in the legislature, so you sort of understand that.
Yeah,
process
I have a little
well, right?
little sense of how that works. And but I think those flexible tools, those kind of unique pockets of money, if you will, sometimes are just what you need to get something over the threshold. I think to Eileen's point, you know, I know I've in my previous visits here, I've heard about organizations, whether it be the BSO or others, that, you know, have substantial dollars committed to housing their artists and technicians and others that make all of the great performances and things that bring people here during the summer months, you know, possible. That's a source of revenue that a developer would very much, you know, need and like to have access to be able to bring a financing package and say, hey, I've got commitments for X number of leases for a certain period of time, for a certain dollar amount, which helps make a project more, you know, viable. And, you know, the question is, how do we use those other parts of the year to meet other needs in the community? And, you know, to the extent that's college students, that kind of works perfectly in terms of the college student cycle and the kind of summer artist community need, but there may be others. So that's going to be something we're going to really be listening and talking to the folks on the ground to tell us how this works and how this can help.
Well, it's great to be able to address those needs specific to the Berkshires. And again, there, I'm sure there are other areas of the state that have different needs that this bill is addressing that maybe we don't have quite as much invested in. You know, the cities of Boston, Worcester certainly are going to see things differently than the Berkshires and the Cape and the Islands and have different needs. To remind you, we're speaking with the Secretary of Housing and Livable Communities at Augustus and Eileen Peltier, the CEO of Hearthway, a regional housing nonprofit here in the Berkshires. And we're talking about housing here in the final couple minutes that we've got left. This hour has zoomed by. It's been a very great conversation to have. The Berkshire Eagle today at the very top of their A section, will interest rate cuts alleviate the housing crunch? How has that affected this whole process? And do you see that being something that we can expect some relief on in the coming months and years?
You know, I would say it's going to be helpful, but it's not going to be the only thing that kind of turns things around. But certainly it
it's
is
a barrier, right?
For it sure. is a barrier. We know that there are some people who've wanted to move. They need to downsize. They need to get a bigger house. They need to do some kind of change in their housing, but have in many cases been reluctant to do so because they're in a place that has a 3 or 4% mortgage and not anxious to trade it for a 7 or 8% mortgage.
Exactly.
And so as mortgage rates come down, we may see people starting to move a little bit and have that kind of, you know, turnover in the housing ecosystem that's been probably bottled up for a couple of years. But I also know there's a lot of projects that were permitted, that were designed, that were ready to go, and then the interest rates went up to 7 or 8%, and they no longer work.
And that's for developers, too, right?
And that's for developers. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this hopefully helps, and we've got a new program, the Momentum Fund, in this bill that helps buy down those rates, has us taking equity positions in deals that can get them down so that they work, they pencil out, and we can get them back on track and get the shovels in the ground.
Well, I encourage everybody to do a little research on this and Google the Affordable Homes Act. There's a really nice fact sheet that gives you all the information that you need about this if you're curious about what we talked about today. Secretary Augustus and Eileen Peltier, I want to thank you both for being here today. And Secretary, congratulations on your election to the Hall of Fame of the Woo Sox.
Thank you.
We have to add that in there.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. So great to have you both here, and hope the rest of your travels in the Berkshires are great.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, have a good day, and we will see you again tomorrow on Morning Drive. Thanks for being here.